Imagine a man who's extremely powerful and he's thrown into prison. He writes a book complaining about how unpleasant his experiences are, and along the way he praises philosophy. He says that philosophy is the only way that you can come to terms with the unfairness of life. This is the story of Boethius. His full name was Anicius Manlius Severinus Boethius, and he was an important political figure in the Gothic Empire at the turn of the 5th and the 6th centuries. His book, The Consolation of Philosophy, is important because it was later taken to be an explanation of some of the underpinnings of Christian philosophy, and it was hugely influential on the poets Geoffrey Chaucer, Dante, and Boccaccio. Through Chaucer, Boethius influenced later poets such as Milton and Spenser, and even Tolkien, who wrote Lord of the Rings. Today in this lecture for East and West Learning Connections, I'll talk about who Boethius was and why his book, The Consolation of Philosophy, was important in European literature. East and West Learning Connections lectures and meetings are a great way for newcomers to Canada to learn about Canadian culture and practice their English. I'm honored to be a part of their programming. Boethius was born around 480 AD in Rome, and he became a kind of prime minister under the Ostrogoth emperor in the year 510. Boethius' title was consul. Essentially, he was a political official with a lot of power in the Ostrogothic Empire. And just a side note, who were the Ostrogoths? Theodoric was the king that Boethius worked for. Theodoric had replaced the previous emperor, Odoacer, who was the guy who had invaded the city of Rome and taken it over. So at that point, the Gothic Empire included Rome. And in the time of Odoacer, they had preserved most of the Roman institutions and beliefs and practices. So essentially, we're looking at a German empire that takes over all of Europe and in a couple of generations has taken on this Italian-Roman culture because they've invaded Italy. So if you think about Rome falling to the Goths, the Vandals, you know, we often think of the decline and the fall of the Roman Empire. And there's actually a famous book by that title by Edward Gibbon. So what we're looking at in the time of Boethius is the start of the decline of the Roman Empire. But it's not really in decline. Roman things are alive and well, and we see some of this classical philosophy in Boethius's book that we're reading. So let's go back to Boethius. He was a consul under the Emperor Theodoric, and he was very learned. He wanted to transmit to the empire all the works of Plato and Aristotle, and he translated Aristotle's Organon, and he wrote commentaries on Aristotle's Categories and on interpretation. And he wrote a commentary on the topics of Cicero. He wrote original things too. And the book, The Consolation of Philosophy, that we're talking about tonight is original to him. So Boethius was a Roman philosopher, probably the last one. Was he a Christian? Probably not. So it's ironic that the ideas in The Consolation of Philosophy are usually taken to be hugely influential on Christianity. Later on, Christian theologians would have thought that Boethius was Christian. But did he believe in God? Probably not. We're not really sure. He believed in a God. He believed in probably a pagan God that was very much like Christian God. But he really believed in philosophy. So what kind of philosophy did he believe in? The object of theology is to understand doctrines delivered by divine revelation. And the object of philosophy is to understand and explain the nature of the world around us. So in this period, philosophy would be a little bit like science. It's a way to know about the world. So again, there's two different things going on. There's two different ways of knowing in Boethius's worldview. There's the way of knowing that's called faith, and then there's a way of knowing that's called reason. And I've talked about these ways of knowing in previous lectures too. So in the past couple of lectures, I talked about kind of an anti-intellectual approach to knowledge that we find in some religions. And I explained that there's different kinds of knowledge, different kinds of ways of getting at knowledge in Christianity. Like in order to know God and to understand God, you have to have faith. And that's a mystical kind of knowledge. And it doesn't rely on your brain or reason. But knowing the world does require your brain, and it doesn't really require so much of the knowledge of God. And of course, what's interesting here is that a Christian person thinks the world is an unfolding of God's divine love. The world is an expression of love. So in theory, if you're a Christian, you can only understand the world properly by understanding it as part of God. But you still need to use your brain to understand the world. And so, yes, when we think about philosophy, there's these two ways of knowing. One is faith and uses mysticism and belief. No thinking is required. And another way of knowing is using your brain, and that's called reason. So why would this be interesting? Well, because these days we have the concept of emotions, and emotions don't really use reason. So if we want to think of an analogy to this ancient view of mysticism, it might be the emotional way of knowing, right? There might be some connection between what we define as emotion and what we define as faith. But let's talk about the backstory of this book, The Consolation of Philosophy. The backstory is that something happened to Boethius. We say in English that he fell out of favor. And what we mean is that he lost the protection of the emperor. He did something that annoyed the emperor. And as a result, he was put in prison, he was exiled, and later he was executed. So this kind of thing happens throughout history. Someone's leader, or someone's second in command to the leader, becomes very powerful and is involved in a lot of decisions that the leader makes. There's a lot of power struggles, right? So if the prime minister has a lot of power and the emperor has power, and one of them thinks that the other one is getting too much power, then that's going to be pretty risky for one of the other. No one wants to be deposed. And sometimes in that situation, the way that the problem was solved is one of those people was executed. And that's really a risk in a government which is not democratic, right? Because there's no legal process to check whether someone's actually committed a crime of treason or not. And usually the crime is basically political anyway. The crime is that you are more popular than the leader. But who knows what Boethius did, really? What we do have is his book, The Consolation of Philosophy. He wrote the book when he was in prison, after he had been, arrested and before he was executed. So what is this consolation word? Consolation is a process of making you feel better. And a good synonym for the word consolation is comfort. So if I give you consolation for your job loss, that means I'm trying to make you feel better about your job loss. I might try to put on some music for you, or I might say, let's go to therapy. Or maybe I would say, let's talk to a friend about it so they can comfort you and tell you things about yourself that are comforting. But this book is not called The Comfort of Philosophy, and that's because the word comfort has a bit of a different meaning for Boethius, and we'll get into that later. But the general idea of the book is that if you have problems in life, you should be turning to the ideas of philosophy to make you feel better, because philosophy tells you the truth about the world, and if you know the truth, you will be comforted and feel at peace. So I suppose that raises our first question tonight. Do you think that knowing more about the world can make you a more peaceful person? Do you think that knowing the truth about a situation can make you feel better? If you know more, will you be happier? And I think this is a very broad question. And if you think about it, different situations are going to give you different answers. So summing up so far, Boethius was a consul or a prime minister in the massive Ostrogothic Empire run by Theodoric the Great. He fell out of favor with Theodoric, and he was exiled and put in prison. When he was in prison, he wrote this book, The Consolation of Philosophy, and mostly he's complaining about the unfairness of life, but then he also explains how philosophy is meant to comfort you and make you think that life is not unfair at all. So the book takes the form of dialogues between Boethius himself and a woman who is the allegorical personification of philosophy. So she's a woman, but she represents philosophy. She is philosophy. And so everything she says is a kind of philosophy. And so the basic premise of the book is that Boethius presents himself as a complainer. He's a whiner. He's whiny and pathetic. And he goes to Lady Philosophy and he complains to this woman that his life is terrible. He is unhappy. Unfair things have happened to him and he's miserable. And what can she do about it? And Philosophy gives him some very important advice. And if you notice a similarity between The Consolation of Philosophy and the book we read last month, which was Dante's Paradiso, if you notice that there's this strange duality between the man who is writing the poem and the woman who is guiding him, you are not wrong, because Dante is picking this kind of thing up from Boethius. This is a convention in medieval poetry that there's this woman who is this abstract, beautiful, perfect guide, and the stupid man is following along and listening to her. So the second thing to know about this book is that it's written in half poetry and half prose. So what is poetry? What is prose? Well, prose is a literary set of words, words that don't rhyme, that don't have poetic features. Poetic features are imagery, metaphor, symbol, and rhyme, you know, all sorts of poetic word features. But that's just poetry in English. In other languages, poetry doesn't have to rhyme. And actually, Boethius is not writing in English, he's writing in Latin. And so his poetry isn't rhyming either, but it's still poetry because today's scholars are familiar with the features of Latin poetry. And so when they read Boethius, they can see, oh, that's poetry and this is not. Now, a really strange thing about this book is that even though it was written in the 6th century, it was very influential on poetry and the late Middle Ages in Europe, by which I mean the 12th to the 15th centuries in Europe. And what that means is that Geoffrey Chaucer, who is, you know, sometimes considered the father of English poetry, Geoffrey Chaucer was very influenced by the philosophy of Boethius. And also Dante was very strongly influenced, and so was Boccaccio. So music philosophers were also influenced by Boethius because he had written a treatise on music, the origins of music. And so Boethius was very influential on poets and science as well. And that's why he's still important today. And his philosophy is in some ways similar to Christianity. And these ideas get picked up by later European writers. And as usual, I'm going to point out that the actual religion of these ideas may have fallen away, but the ideas themselves still remain really relevant. And people hold on to those ideas, even though they're not aware of the origin of the ideas, or especially if they are not Christian. So, for example, one of the ideas that we've got from Boethius is this idea about the harmony of the world and the order of everything. And I talked about this idea of heavenly order last month and the month before, I think, and it means that according to this worldview, everything has a place and everything is in its place in the proper world. My grandmother used to say, you know, a place for everything and everything in its place. And she meant that the house should be tidy and orderly. Well, this is a worldview that views the world as a very orderly house. And the order of the things is what keeps the world peaceful and it keeps it, you know, keep going. So if something falls out of place, then the world kind of stops moving and it becomes chaotic and we have violence and struggle and problems. But of course, that idea is not invented by Boethius. And we've talked about it in past lectures. But Boethius is one of the people whose work transmits this idea down the generations to our time. And this idea is therefore picked up from Roman philosophy by people who are reading Boethius's book, The Consolation of Philosophy. So for example, Dante, he's read The Consolation of Philosophy. He discusses harmony and order in the world, and Dante is getting it from Boethius. And I'm talking about the history of ideas now. How do ideas develop and change? And I think this is another bigger question for us. What do you think about the history of ideas? How do you think the idea of love has changed over 1,000 years? How do you think the idea of truth has changed over 1,000 years? What about virtue, the idea of virtue? I guess I think the history of ideas is important because we tend to think that ideas just are. They just exist. Like, what is justice? Well, we know the definition, but when we learn other languages and when we go to other places, we realize that actually these words might have slightly different connotations and meanings in other cultures and contexts. So the idea of virtue might have a different idea in one culture compared to another. And an example that I've given in past lectures is boasting. So for ancient Greek soldiers like Achilles, it was very virtuous for him to boast about how brave he was. But that kind of boasting is not appropriate if you are a nurse today in Canada. So the meanings of concepts change depending on what cultural context you approach them in. You know, maybe they don't change that drastically. You know, love is still love. But maybe there's different associations, different imagery, and maybe some different implications. So I mentioned the Consolation of Philosophy is written in two different formats. Sometimes the format is a song, and sometimes it's prose. At the very beginning of the book, it begins with a song or poetry, and this is called meter one, or metric one. And in the first song, Boethius is complaining that he has white hair, and he's singing gloomy songs, and he complains, "Age has come upon me without warning." So he's basically whining that he is old and gray and he's about to die. But then he complains that death will not come to him. And I'm going to quote from my translation, "Death, if he come, not in the years of sweetness, but often called to those who want to end their misery, is welcome. My cries he does not hear. Cruel, he will not close my weeping eyes." So in other words, death is being unkind to him by not letting him die and letting him suffer even more. Pretty pathetic, right? So he even complains that his friends told him that he was fortunate when in fact he was not fortunate. So the implication is that his friends lied to him and are somehow responsible for how unhappy Boethius is. Again, very pathetic. But, you know, perhaps I'm lacking in compassion here. And here this raises another question. What kind of compassion do we need to have for someone who makes these kinds of complaints? What kind of self-compassion could Boethius show? What compassion should a listener show? I think compassion's an interesting question, and I think that Boethius doesn't really pick it up. So in the next section in the first book, Boethius writes in prose, and he says that Lady Philosophy arrives. He doesn't use the word Lady Philosophy right away, but he describes her, and the reader of the text would automatically recognize her as a personified figure of Lady Philosophy. And Boethius describes her as a woman who is full of majesty. So this is a figure of a very strong woman, and for someone who thinks that the Middle Ages is anti-feminist, they might be surprised by this. But most abstract concepts were, when they were personified by writers in this period, were portrayed as female. Now this may have something to do with the fact that abstract words have a feminine gender in the language Latin, but I think it's also a cultural tradition. So this lady is described as having eyes that shine like fire, and she's said to have varying stature. So sometimes she can appear to be the right size as a human, maybe 5 feet tall, and other times she appears to be as tall as the sky. So the sky in her head touches the heavens. And so this would be a representation of the fact that the practice of philosophy covers our practical daily life on earth, very human concerns, like what to do on a daily basis. And it also covers our spiritual life and the heavens and God and the potential for growth. So on Lady Philosophy's clothing are some marks, and they are the symbols pi and theta. So these are Greek letters. They're the first letters of Greek words that mean practical and theoretical, which are the two divisions of philosophy. And that also relates to this metaphor of her height, right? Her height could be very high in the sky, or it could be quite low, like every person's height. In the hands of Lady Philosophy, there are books in one hand, and then a scepter in another hand. So a scepter is a rod that a king holds, a European king anyway. So these two things indicate first her power and second her knowledge. And so in the second prose section, the author describes what Lady Philosophy looks like, and he tells us what Lady Philosophy says. And what she says is that bad women have come to Boethius and are giving him trouble. So she complains that these women have tempted him and lied to him. And I'll quote now from your translation. She says, quote, "Who has suffered these seducing mummers to approach the sick man? Never do they support those in sorrow by any healing remedies, but rather do ever foster the sorrow by poisonous sweets. They free not the minds of men from disease, but accustom them thereto." So what's a mummer? Who are these women who are mummers? Well, the word mummer is an interesting one in the translation. A mummer was an actor that was associated with Christmas in the 18th and 19th centuries in England. So there used to be a tradition at Christmas of going around from house to house or town to town, performing maybe miracle plays or other kinds of plays. And so a mummer is an actor who performs a mummer's play. So a mummer is not necessarily a bad thing, but what's happening here is that Lady Philosophy is pointing out that the women who are annoying Boethius, the women who are pretending and lying to him, are lying to him like actors pretend in a play. So who are these muses, these attendants who visit Boethius? Well, they are women who are allegorical, again, and they represent, they symbolize the practice of poetry and stories and music. So what Lady Philosophy is saying is that Boethius has been using poetry and music to console himself and comfort himself. And she accuses them. She says that these women have not freed the minds of men from disease, so they have not solved any mental health issues. Instead, they have accustomed the minds of men to the disease. So instead of comforting men, they are making him get used to his suffering and preventing him from healing from it. So Lady Philosophy is very critical of the practice of poetry and music. And to me, this raises the question of whether she's lacking in compassion, because I think music could be a good therapy for our suffering. So she goes so far to call the muses of poetry and music strumpets or prostitutes. She calls them vulgar and sirens. She says they are seducing him. And there's definitely a sexual connotation here. There's this idea that they are somehow betraying Boethius or corrupting him. And so Lady Boethius goes towards Boethius and she looks in his face and she tries to speak to him and tell him to pay attention to philosophy. Well, interestingly, how does she do that? In the second song, we get this very poetic, beautiful description of the sky, the sun, and the moon. So there's an irony here, because even though Lady Philosophy is criticizing music and poetry, she's actually using poetry to draw our attention to the philosophical ideas in the book. So the best modern analogy would be like, if Lady Philosophy were to see us feeling anxious and then texting on our phones, and then she turns to us and says, "Don't text on your phones, that will just make you more anxious. Stop using your phone, go and do something outdoors, go talk to a friend, go help a relative. Stop being whiny and pathetic. All things happen for a reason, be braver." And then what she does is she picks up her phone. Lady Philosophy would pick up her phone and start texting and tweeting this message to her friends. So that's the irony here. Lady Philosophy is criticizing poetry, but she is also using poetry to teach and persuade and comfort. So let's look at this imagery she uses. In the second song, she says that the mind is a darkness and unhappiness is growing. But she says, this man used to wander freely. She says, this man was free to the open heaven. His habit was to wander into the pass of the sky to watch the light of the bright sun, to inquire into the brightness of the chill moon. So these are all good things. And she was saying that in the past, this man fit carefully into the right place in the universe. He had his proper place in the order of the universe, and he was inquisitive and curious in the right way. But now, she says, his reason's light is extinct, meaning that his capacity to think and reason has been damaged, and that is why he is sad. So the other thing that's going on in this metaphor about stormy seas that have replaced the heavenly order, what's going on here is a representation of the mind itself. So how does the mind work? So the metaphor of the stormy seas depicts the mind and its emotions and feelings as being unpredictable and dangerous. It's a kind of territory that you have to journey over, which will cause you pain and suffering. You don't know where you're going. You don't have a lot of control over this journey. Think of a boat on a storm-tossed sea. Well, this is the metaphor of the troubled mind as a troubled sea. And this metaphor is pretty much universal, and it definitely predates Boethius. And we can think of lots of contemporary examples too. So right away, I think of the song from the 1960s, "Like a Bridge Over Troubled Waters." So that's the same metaphor. So Simon and Garfunkel singing, "Like a bridge over troubled waters, I will lay me down." And the troubled waters represent the troubles of life. And what are the troubles of life? Well, basically, there are sorrows in life, but those sorrows are within our mind. So the troubles, the sea of troubles that we're talking about is actually our troubled mind. And that's what's going on in this book, The Consolation of Philosophy, as well. So I find this song really interesting by Simon and Garfunkel, and I was reading on the internet that the lyrics came to Paul Simon kind of intuitively and unconsciously. And even Paul Simon says reportedly, like, where did that come from? It doesn't seem like me. He wasn't really aware of the process. It was very intuitive. And he says, actually, the concept was inspired by another song, I'll Be Your Bridge Over Deep Water. So the line exists already, the concept exists, but the song itself seemed to come from nowhere. So I wonder if this context is just very deeply rooted in our psyche, this metaphor of our emotions as troubled water. Certainly the song is very calming, and I think if we look at how the song works on people, the song appears to calm people down. Well, that's exactly what Boethius is looking for when he's listening to music. And that's what Lady Philosophy seems to be criticizing. She seems to be criticizing the fact that we use music to comfort ourselves. And yet at the same time, she's also using music and poetry by writing it and using it to console Boethius himself. So if we think about the song, in the song, Art Garfunkel sings, "Like a bridge over troubled water, I will lay me down." So he's saying, I will console you. And what's the best thing about this book, The Consolation of Philosophy, is that's what Lady Philosophy is saying she'll do. She is saying to Boethius, I will console you. But of course, she is philosophy. So what she means when she says, I will console you, is not that she is a woman who will console him in the typical way of giving him a hug, but that he will be consoled with reason and ideas. So what are these reasons and ideas that she presents to him? Well, later on in the book of Consolation of Philosophy, we get to some very harmonious descriptions of the worldly order. In the last lecture, I described the music of the spheres and the idea that the world is held in place by the love of God. The movements of the spheres create heavenly music, and then that heavenly music is part of what keeps everything in place. And in book 2, meter 8, we have a description of this kind of thing. So let's look at that. That's on page 27. So we notice that Boethius says, the sea keeps its waves from the land to make sure that the earth is not harmed by waves coming onto the land. And he says that only happens because of God's love. Now he's not talking about the Christian God. He's probably talking about a pagan God. Anyway, he says that God's love rules both the earth and the sea, and if love should slacken its hold, that means if the love should let go, then everything is going to fall into war and chaos. So it's a love that keeps people together and stops them from fighting, and it's love that stops the earth from fighting the sea. So in other words, love prevents earthquakes. So I wanted to show you this passage because the passage is drawn on by Geoffrey Chaucer, and he's the 14th century English poet who I keep on mentioning. Chaucer uses this passage when he writes a poem called The Knight's Tale. That's one of the Canterbury Tales. And that's a story about two brothers who are taken prisoner and fall in love with the woman, the same woman, while they're kept in prison. They just see her from the window of their prison and they both fall in love with her. And one man is let free and he's able to try to marry Emily, but at the last minute, the other brother gets free too, and then they have to fight it out to the death. So the story, Chaucer found the story in a poem by Boccaccio, and then he decided to translate it into Middle English. And then one of the reasons it's so famous is because he includes this kind of philosophy that's drawn from Boethius. So what are some of these philosophical ideas? So in some ways, Boethius is just transmitting a translation of Aristotle. He's trying to transmit basic Aristotelian concepts. So let's look at book 4, prose 2. This is a very long section. It's later in the book. So we'll see a description of what a good man is or what an evil man is. So basically, Lady Philosophy says that, quote, evil is not a power. So evil men are not powerful. And she says at the end of the section, evil men do not actually exist. She says, quote, of those who are evil, I do not deny that they are evil, but that they are purely. So she's saying, I don't deny that they're evil. I deny that they are. I deny that they exist. In other words, she's saying an evil person is not really a person at all. And what it means to be a good person is the same as what it means to be a person. So we might translate this into modern idiom by saying that if you're an evil human, you're not being human, you've somehow lost your humanity. So another aspect of Lady Philosophy's approach seems to be to try to prove to Boethius that good people are happy and bad people are miserable. And so when we punish wicked people, that will make them happier. So I don't know about you, I found this very non-intuitive, but I see where she's going with it. The point is to try to bring someone who's unhappy to peace with the fact that this is how the world is. The world is the right way, and we can accept our difficulties. And this goes back to the very beginning of the book in which Lady Philosophy criticized Boethius for being miserable. And there are several chapters that follow, which are about the distinction between faith and fortune and the nature of chance. And in these books, these chapters, Lady Philosophy tries to explain why things are meant to be the way they are. So the world is designed in a good way, and really all events are for the better. So whatever happens, even if it's really terrible, this is the way the world should be. The problem is that humans have a very limited understanding of the world, and so we cannot conceive of the true order of things. And of course, this is very much a Christian worldview. I want to say that it's a precursor to a Christian worldview, because even though Boethius isn't Christian, he seems like a proto-Christian. He seems to be supporting the view that God created the world, and because God created the world is a good place, and fundamentally, everything is going to happen for a good purpose. So everything that happens is good because God has made it happen and God is good. So I don't know that this answer is that much different from a Buddhist or Stoic perspective. Basically, it seems to suggest that we should just accept the world as it is and try to be brave and peaceful in the face of suffering. But to me, calling the world good when it seems bad essentially seems like a denial. It seems like an attempt to conquer our own fear and worry about evil in the world by saying that that doesn't exist. And I'm not sure that's a useful exercise. I mean, I think it's good to try to combat fear and worry, but I don't know that it's a good idea to deny them. And I'm not sure that we have to call evil good in order to conquer that fear and worry. So I would sum up by saying that Lady Philosophy's answer is pretty unsatisfying in a modern context, but the way Boethius arrives at this conclusion is interesting. So the imagery he uses, the examples he discusses, these are all interesting. And I have to say that ultimately I would disagree with him, but maybe that's also because I don't buy the fundamental premise that the world was designed by an intelligent mind. And I think if Boethius lived today, he might come up with a different understanding for, you know, why we should not be miserable. So I'm going to finish by reading a passage from Book 2, Meter 3. And so this is poetry that describes the sun rising. So Phoebus is the sun. When Phoebus from his roseate car begins to spread his light across the sky, his overwhelming fires dim the white faces of the paling stars. Warmed by the west wind's gentle breath, the groves blush pink with roses in the spring. Let but the stormy south wind madly blow, and the thorns are stripped of their loveliness. Sometimes the sea gleams calm, serene, unruffled. Sometimes the north wind whips up raging storms and overturns the sea. Earth's beauty seldom stays, but ever changes. Go on, then. Trust in the passing fortunes, the fleeting pleasures of men. It is decreed by firm eternal law, nothing that comes to be can firm remain. So this would seem to be a challenge to the idea that there's order. This poem seems to suggest that the world is actually kind of a chaotic place most of the time. But nevertheless, this passage is very beautiful in describing this imagery of the sea, either the sea as unruffled and calm and serene, or whipped up in raging storms. Both of those images are kind of timeless, and they show up in poetry and songs and literature today. They're pretty much universal images, and I think this is one of the